This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, August 9, 2005. From KPFK in Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado. With less than a week before a draft constitution is due, the Iraqi National Assembly struggles to break a deadlock. The Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco hears arguments to dismiss the largest gender discrimination lawsuit in U.S. history. And Iraq's nuclear program is under scrutiny. We'll talk to Norman Solomon about the way the media spins towards a war agenda. These stories and more after the headlines.
I'm Leanne Caldwell with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Five accused Cuban spies, also known as the Cuban Five, will get a new trial. Their case was dismissed due to prejudices. Mitch Perry reports from WMNF in Tampa.
A three-judge panel of the 11th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals has ruled that the five men did not receive a fair trial in Miami because of community prejudice and extensive publicity. The defense argued, and the panel agreed, that prejudice against Cuban Premier Fidel Castro and his communist government runs too high in Miami for a fair trial. All five men were convicted 4 years ago of serving as unregistered agents of a foreign government. Evidence revealed that they had spied on Cuban exiles, but the men argued that they were monitoring far-right terrorist groups that had a record of violence against Cuba. Leonard Weinglass is an attorney for one of the defendants, Antonio Guerrero.
And so this is a remarkable decision, an incredible tribute to the vitality of the appellate court, and it's just a marvel to read, and we all feel very appreciative and grateful for this decision.
Another attorney in the case says he is not sure where his client would prefer the trial to be moved to, but preferably someplace outside of South Florida. Mitch Perry, Free Speech Radio News, Tampa.
Lawyers for detainees held at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, appealed to the Supreme Court to reveal the legality of military tribunals. Mike Santetos has more from Washington, D.C.
Attorneys for Salim Ahmed Hamdan, Osama bin Laden's former driver, are hoping the Supreme Court will overturn the decision that approved the use of tribunals instead of the standard military courts for trying suspected terrorists at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. One of Hamdan's attorneys, Georgetown law professor Neil Katyal, said the appeals court decision established that neither the Constitution nor the Geneva Convention apply at Guantanamo Bay.
The Court of Appeals essentially said that detainees at Guantanamo Bay have no constitutional rights and no treaty rights, that basically the president is free to do what he wants at Guantanamo, that it is tantamount to a legal black hole.
The tribunals, approved on July 15th by a three-judge panel that included Supreme Court nominee John Roberts, would be the first since World War II. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., this is Mike Santetos.
The EPA released revised radiation standards for the proposed nuclear waste site at Yucca Mountain, Nevada. The new proposal creates a two-tier system. It will create standards of radiation exposure for 10,000 years. Then it will create a second set of standards to be followed up for up to 1 million years. The EPA is attempting to comply with a lawsuit decided last year that said EPA's radiation exposure guidelines were insufficient for the site 90 miles outside of Las Vegas to store highly radioactive nuclear waste. The United States and Venezuela's relations are deeply troubled. Venezuela President Hugo Chavez told a forum of school children from 144 countries that the U.S. will lose if they invade his country. Meanwhile, the United States threatened to place sanctions on Venezuela over a refusal to work with the U.S. in counter-drug operations. Greg Wilpert has more from Caracas.
The U.S. State Department responded to Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez by suggesting that it might impose sanctions on Venezuela for its lack of cooperation with the U.S.'s Drug Enforcement Administration, which is a move that U.S. officials already suggested a while ago. The move comes after President Chavez had said that he will suspend Venezuela's cooperation with the DEA. He said the DEA itself is involved in drug trafficking and is also using its Venezuelan offices for spying on Venezuela. The U.S. government has repeatedly stated that drug control cooperation with Venezuela was poor, despite statistics that showed that drug interdiction in Venezuela has increased substantially since Chavez came into office. Chavez made his comments during a news conference after having voted in local elections on Sunday. Chavez's party won 58% of all offices that were up for a vote, and with his allied parties, they won 80% of all city council seats. Greg Wilpert reporting for Free Speech Radio News from Caracas, Venezuela.
Protest over an inquiry into 1984 riots caused the Indian parliament to close. Binu Alex has more from Ahmedabad.
Both houses of India's parliament were forced to adjourn due to the protest following the release of a 9th commission of inquiry report into the 1984 riots, where more than 3,000 Sikhs were massacred. The report said local Congress leaders and workers had either incited or helped the mobs in attacking the Sikhs. Now, opposition members are demanding the prosecution of named members of the governing Congress party, one of them a minister. The government has rejected the opposition demand, but says that it is prepared to hold a parliamentary debate on the issue. From Ahmedabad, Benu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
And I'm Leanne Caldwell from WPFW in Washington, D.C. The UN's International Atomic Energy Agency, or IAEA, board is holding an emergency meeting today in response to Iran resuming work on a uranium conversion plant. The board is discussing a draft resolution presented by the European Union, which warns Tehran against resuming the uranium project. Iran has responded that they are willing to continue negotiations with the EU3, Germany, France, and Britain, and with the EU, but on its own terms. Joining us to talk about these developments is Norman Solomon, Executive Director for the Institute for Public Accuracy and author of War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. In your book, you talk about the way that the media helps set an agenda for war. Do you think that's what's happening now with Iran?
I think we're really in the midst of a process where the White House is driving media coverage about the Iran situation. And this is what you might say a process of putting flagstones in the pathway towards a military confrontation, something that's very much sought by the Bush administration. And so we keep hearing about these nuclear issues, about connections to terrorism. We're hearing about how bombs are being found in Iraq that have their origins in Iran, and so forth. This is all pretty much standard agenda building for war.
And you were in Iran in June. Can you talk about everyday people's responses to the criticisms about their nuclear program?
Well, I did talk to a lot of people from many walks of life in Tehran in June, from the bazaars to the universities to some of the high officials and others. And I found that there was apparently almost unanimous belief that Iran had the right to develop nuclear power for electrical generation. And in a way, it's a victory for the PR campaign that was launched half a century ago by President Eisenhower and the nuclear industry about atoms for peace. And now the White House is in the paradoxical situation of claiming what one White House after another has denied, and that is that indeed you can't separate nuclear power and nuclear weapons. I think in a nutshell, the public in Iran is firmly behind the government's contention that it has every right to develop nuclear power plants. Many people told me, hey, it's good enough for you in the United States, and don't you think we're good enough for nuclear power here in Iran?
Iran says that they're ready to come to the table and keep negotiating. Do you think that the EU is still willing to do the same?
Yeah, I think the European countries do want to negotiate. There's just a divergence of viewpoint where the notions of sovereignty that are held in high places and throughout Iranian society are just not shared. I mean, I think that the hypocrisy in particular of Washington is acutely understood in Iran, even if not so much in the United States and certainly not acknowledged by the American press corps. Here you have, not far from Iran, the country of Israel, whose government has at least 200 nuclear warheads. You have Pakistan with nuclear bombs, a government in Pakistan that has not gotten along very well overall with Iran, supported Iran's mortal enemy, the Taliban in Afghanistan. You have India, which has many nuclear weapons and which the United States government just agreed to enter into a nuclear cooperation pact. And none of the countries I just mentioned, other than Iran, are signatories to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. So in many ways, you have, for instance, India getting a lot more goodies from Washington outside of the Nonproliferation Treaty, while the U.S. is basically threatening Iran, which is staying within that treaty.
Norman Solomon is the executive director for the Institute for Public Accuracy and author of War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld said at a Pentagon press conference today that weapons found in Iraq are coming from Iran. However, he would not say whether he felt the weapons were from the Iranian government. Rumsfeld added that he expects violence in Iraq to increase over the next few weeks and months, and that there is no exit strategy to begin withdrawing troops come next spring. Chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Richard Myers, said that some soldiers should expect to serve a third term in Iraq and that more troops are needed there, but they should come from Iraq, not the U.S. Mitch Jezerich has more from Washington.
An aggravated Donald Rumsfeld addressed reporters today at the Pentagon concerning the status of Iraq.
Zarqawi's not going to give up. That's what he does. He gets up in the morning and wants to recruit people and arm them and finance them and kill people.
Rumsfeld was asked to verify new reports that the Pentagon is claiming that weapons used by the Iraqi resistance were coming from Iran, and whether he thought the Iranian government was responsible.
It is true that weapons clearly, unambiguously from Iran have been found in Iraq. I'm not going to comment on the other aspects of your question.
How many, sir?
Oh, no, goodness, how can you know? You only know what you know. That's a big border, and it's notably unhelpful for the Iranians to be allowing weapons of those types to cross the border.
Rumsfeld also denied that the U.S. military is planning on bringing some troops home starting in the spring of next year.
It takes time. It's going along very well, and we're pleased with the progress. The level of the insurgency is going to be a function as to what the of a variety of things which will affect the conditions. And the drawdowns that will occur eventually will obviously be based on those conditions. Some of those variables that I've mentioned repeatedly are what are the Iranians doing? Are they going to be helpful or unhelpful?
Rumsfeld also said that he expects violence in Iraq to increase as the deadline for an Iraqi constitution is less than a week away and with elections planned for December. Joining Rumsfeld at the press conference was the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Richard Myers, who said that large-scale attacks like the one that killed 14 U.S. soldiers last week will likely continue. Myers said more troops were needed in Iraq, but that they wouldn't be U.S. soldiers. And he also said that U.S. military personnel could expect to serve a third tour.
I mean, there's the possibility of people going back for a third tour. Sure. That's always out there. We are at war.
Active duty.
Reservists are being held to 24 months of duty and 13 cumulative and 13 months, of course, in on the ground in theater in whatever country you send them.
Meanwhile, the mother of one fallen soldier, Cindy Sheehan, has been camping outside of President Bush's ranch in Crawford, Texas, demanding a meeting with the president while he continues with his month-long vacation. Sheehan spoke with Free Speech Radio News via her cell phone.
You know, I knew when they were saying they were going to start withdrawing the troops that it was a lie, because they're building bases the size of Sacramento, California, in Iraq. They're not never leaving, and we as peace activists and we in the anti-war movement, we have to raise our voices louder and say, bring our troops home now. I'm so upset by this. They're probably going to send more National Guard troops over. They're probably going to send people who have been there two or three times already. And I think it's not just. I think it's a travesty.
And have you made any progress in your attempt to meet with the president?
Not that I know of, because we haven't heard anything from the ranch since Saturday when Stephen Hadley and Joe Hagan came down to chat with me.
Have they been asking you to leave yet?
We haven't been asked to leave yet, but we've been pushed onto a real small strip of land, and this is a rumor that on Thursday we'll become a security threat to the president, and then we'll be asked to leave, and if we don't leave, we'll be arrested.
On Thursday you'll become a security threat. Why?
Well, that's what we'd like to know, because if we're not one now, how come we will be on Thursday? But we think it's because Condoleezza Rice and Donald Rumsfeld are coming out here, and we think it's because the president has to drive down to a ranch right below us, and he doesn't want to pass people who disagree with him.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Mitch Jezerich in Washington.
At least 28 Iraqis died and over 60 were wounded in continued violence in Iraq. One U.S. soldier was killed and two were injured as a result of a suicide car bomb in Baghdad as the U.S. convoy made its way through the city. Meanwhile, members of the Iraqi National Assembly resumed talks in an attempt to break a deadlock over the draft constitution. As the constitution, which is due in less than 1 week, continues to be negotiated, other political issues have taken a back seat. Dave Enders interviews Salama Al-Khafaji, a member of the Iraqi National Assembly.
In a climate in which political journalism has become an increasingly tough proposition, with varied pronouncements coming from Iraq's squabbling politicians, Al-Khafaji, a former dental professor, speaks with refreshing candor about the political situation. A former member of the U.S.-appointed Governing Council, she helped draft the transitional administrative law under Paul Bremer's Coalition Provisional Authority, and is seen as close to the U.S. project here.
When Bremer, I told him once that when Mr. Bremer came to Iraq, we have no terrorism, but when he left, we have a big numbers of them, and he was a specialist in fighting terrorism.
Khafaji says she disagrees with the notion that Iraq is a sovereign country, especially when the U.S. military continues to detain Iraqis and maintain its own prisons. In June, Al-Khafaji was one of the 82 signatories in the 275-member parliament of a letter circulated by MP Falah Hassan, calling for a parliamentary vote on the status of foreign militaries in Iraq.
These forces have to have a schedule for leaving from Iraq and having a schedule of the preparing of the Iraqi forces in different sites and making an agreement for their presence.
Al-Khafaji, who heads the Assembly's Human Rights Committee, says that a timetable for withdrawal could slow recruitment of jihadis from inside and outside the country.
It will affect those who are with the extreme religious ideas. This will affect them. You are speaking about that American troops, these American troops having this type of aims and they are going to withdraw, and this will decrease the reasons. Nowadays, you have seen that the terrorist action have been increased. Why? Because new groups are growing. Some young men are even old men. They are collecting together, making new groups and working against the American troops or against Shia.
She also said the U.S. military's prisons in the country are used by fighters to recruit.
In the prisons, especially the biggest ones, like the Al-Matar or Abu Ghraib, you know that the prisoners which go inside the prisons, they are collected together, the terrorists and those the innocents. And when they go out of the prisons, they taught them how to be terrorists. So when they are innocent and they get out of the prison, they become new terrorists.
Asked if the possible ratification of a new constitution in October would slow the guerrilla war, Al-Khafaji insists that a trial for Saddam Hussein would be more important, to prove to some of those continuing to fight that the restoration of Hussein's government would never occur. In Baghdad, I'm David Enders for FSRN.
The U.S. Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals in San Francisco heard arguments on whether to dismiss a lawsuit alleging that Walmart discriminates against female employees in pay and promotions. The case is the largest class-action gender discrimination lawsuit in U.S. history, affecting over 1.5 million former and current female Walmart employees. Max Pringle reports.
Walmart is appealing a lower court decision to let the suit go to trial. The suit claims that Walmart routinely paid men better than women and passed women over for promotion more frequently. The plaintiff's attorney said that women hold only about 1/3 of the company's managerial salaried positions, even though they make up about 2/3 of the workforce. Walmart argued that's because they receive a larger number of managerial applications from men. Walmart's lead attorney, Theodore Boutros, told the three-judge panel that a company-sponsored survey shows no significant disparity in pay and promotions between men and women throughout the chain. He also argued that Walmart is not liable because there is no across-the-board company policy on pay and promotions. Therefore, each store is like a separate business. Boutros said that's why the suit's class certification should be dismissed.
We think our arguments are very strong, that the class certification order violated due process, violated Title VII, that it would be bad for employers all over the country and for employees, for that matter, if this class certification was upheld.
Last year, District Court Judge Martin Jenkins ruled that the class action certification was warranted because lawyers for the women provided enough evidence to prove a pattern of discrimination. Brad Seligman, one of the attorneys representing the women, said the class action suit has made Walmart stand up and take notice.
That's why we need class actions. Individual suits mean nothing to a giant like Walmart. They could lose a zillion suits. They won't change their policies. A nationwide class action is the one lever that can have them finally decide they got to change what they're doing.
Betty Dukes is the lead plaintiff in the suit and a greeter at Walmart in Pittsburgh, California. Her pay has increased from $8 to $13 an hour since the suit was filed. She predicted that the Ninth Circuit will rule in her favor.
I was impressed with the interest that all of the judges took towards this case and the question that they asked, and I was doubly impressed with the response from our legal representations. I think that we are on the road to victory.
Walmart is the nation's largest private employer and operates 3,400 stores. Walmart has been under the gun lately for its employment practices. Earlier this year, it agreed to pay a record $11 million to settle a civil probe by federal authorities into charges it knowingly hired contractors who employed undocumented workers. Critics also charge that the Arkansas-based retail giant mistreats its workers and that the workers' low wages force employees to seek government aid for health care and other benefits. The Ninth Circuit panel gave no indication as to when it would rule on whether the case should go to trial. The plaintiffs are asking for unspecified damages. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Max Pringle in San Francisco.
The 60th anniversary of the atomic bombings of Japan has sparked demonstrations and commemorations throughout the world. In New Mexico, Remembering the Blast includes a message to the scientists and management at Los Alamos National Laboratory to abolish all work on nuclear weapons and the existing weapons stockpile. FSRN's Leslie Clark reports.
It started here. Let's stop it here, is the theme anti-nuclear activists in New Mexico are chanting as the world remembers the atomic bombings of Japan. It was at Los Alamos National Laboratory in 1945 that scientists created the world's first atomic bombs. Today, as much as 85% of the lab's $2.5 billion budget goes towards weapons development. David Krieger, president of the Nuclear Age Peace Foundation, is calling on today's scientists at Los Alamos Lab to examine their work on weapons of mass destruction.
What the scientists at Los Alamos are doing is contributing to the insecurity, the indecency, the immorality, and the illegality that has become America in the year 2005.
Instead, Krieger says, scientists and managers at the lab could play a much different role.
They could stand up and be counted. They could be courageous. They could be honest. They could be forthright. They could take a chance on life instead of giving their lives to death.
Survivors of the bombings of Nagasaki and Hiroshima came to New Mexico asking for the abolition of nuclear weapons. As part of a day-long commemoration at Los Alamos, two hibakusha, as atomic bomb survivors are called, presented their call for the abolition of nuclear weapons to Francis Berting, chair of the Los Alamos County Council. Koji Ueda.
It was their hope for a long time that the 21st century, when it dawned, could be a century of peace without nuclear weapons. But look where we are now, 30,000 of them in existence in a factory up the street. And we really have to do something to bring about peace in this century.
And the factory is working to minimize the number and increase the safety while we are trying to provide the verification so that we know when we say there are no more, we know there are no more and nobody is going to surprise us.
But Mr. Ueda emphasized all work on nuclear weapons, including the technology for verification, must be stopped. He says by looking at the suffering of the victims of the atomic bombings of Nagasaki and Hiroshima, it becomes clear humanity and nuclear weapons cannot coexist. David Krieger agrees. He says Americans, too, continue to suffer the effects of being citizens of the only country in the world to ever use a nuclear weapon.
Something has happened to America. I think our souls have been contaminated by our failure to come to terms with what we've done. It's very important that the American people awaken to the sort of stupor that we're in, because it's leading to a terrible consequence for the United States.
Hiroshima's! No more Nagasaki's! No more Nagasaki's! No more Hibakusha!
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leslie Clark in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
More nuclear weapons!
Connecticut and Louisiana recently passed state laws that will help veterans returning from Iraq get improved treatment for exposure to depleted uranium. 12 other states have similar legislation in the works. State lawmakers increasingly believe that the Department of Defense is not doing enough to address the issue at the federal level. One person who helped convince Connecticut lawmakers that action is desperately needed is a veteran from the first Gulf War, Melissa Sterry. Fritz Meyer spoke with her and files this report.
Since serving in Kuwait in 1991 and 92, Melissa Sterry has suffered 3 heart attacks and twice undergone heart surgery. She has bronchial asthma and restrictive airways disease, and she's one of the lucky ones. 6 of the 8 friends she served with have died, all before the age of 35. Sterry and many others believe that exposure to depleted uranium and other agents is to blame.
So there was the depleted uranium, there was the experimental vaccines, there were the oil well fires, there were the chemicals that were soaked into our uniforms when they were made in order to suppress body heat to keep us from being picked up on infrared scans.
But certainly depleted uranium, or DU, is one of the most likely suspects for the cause of her ill health, especially her 3 cardiac arrhythmias, which she says would not have developed without some change to her DNA. Iraqi doctors have reported a rise in childhood cancers of up to 400% in populations exposed to DU, and there are anecdotal reports of birth defects among the children of veterans of the Iraq wars in the U.S. Again, Melissa Sterry.
If we go back and look at radiation usage in radiation wars, we can look at what happened to the Hiroshima survivors and Nagasaki and how radiation mutates the genetic structure of our RNA and our DNA, and that gets passed on to our children.
Illnesses among U.S. service personnel from the first Gulf War are staggering. Of some 697,000 troops who've served, about 221,000 are on permanent disability. Many scientists are coming to the conclusion that DU played a major role. Dr. Doug Rocky is a retired major with the Army Reserves and an expert on DU. He says there is no way to protect soldiers against contamination.
The problem you run into is the gas masks that are issued to the troops in Gulf War I, the same as the gas masks were issued to the troops in Gulf War II, only remove particulates and things at like 0.5 and 0.7 micron and above. Now, this nasty stuff is down in the 0.1 micron range. So this DU particle is just flying through the air, and it goes right into the body.
Almost everyone agrees that DU weapons are brilliant at burning through armor and just about any other material on the planet. The Department of Defense would like to keep them in the arsenal and has consistently denied that there is any significant health risk to soldiers who are exposed to depleted uranium. But Sterry points out they once said the same thing about the chemicals used to defoliate the jungles in Vietnam.
By the early 70s, people were saying we're sick, and it is the agent series, the defoliants, Agent Orange, Agent Blue, Agent Green, that's making us sick. Hundreds of studies were done by people like the RAND Corporation saying, no, no, the agent series are not making you sick. There's nothing wrong with you. We now know from history that that was an incorrect statement.
Connecticut State Representative Roger Michel, co-chair of the Veterans Affairs Committee, shares Sterry's concerns about depleted uranium.
There's over 650,000 tons of depleted uranium that we dropped over there, and we can't see it. It's in the water, it's in the air, and then within the air currents, it could travel worldwide. This could be a major catastrophe if it's not addressed.
The Connecticut legislature's next move is to determine the best test for DU contamination and to make it available for all returning Connecticut veterans. In Hartford, Connecticut, I'm Fritz Mayer reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. I'm Aura Bogado.